You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, September 27th, 2022. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Trita Parsi, Executive Vice President at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, the ongoing protest movement in Iran. First, Senate to vote on the continuing resolution today, or at least attempt to. The real question is, will it ultimately include Manchin's permitting plan? Meanwhile, in Texas, Attorney General Ken Paxton flees while being served a subpoena in an abortion lawsuit. New report out, Secret Service confiscated 24 agents' cell phones for the January 6th investigation. Meanwhile, Federal Reserve's interest rate hikes on track to create a recession and to achieve its ultimate goal, disciplining labor. North Carolina Senate race still pulling even. Vance and Ryan set two debates. And Don Bolduc does a pirouette in New Hampshire. Perfectly landed. South Dakota, Kristi Noem under an ethics investigation. Meanwhile, in Florida, DeSantis' contract awards are going, weirdly, to people who then suddenly become big donors. Putin set to annex parts of occupied Ukraine. New reports that the draft isn't going so well in Russia. University of Idaho may stop providing birth control because of Idaho's abortion ban. Former Republican congressman writes a tell-all book, says his Republican colleagues have serious cognitive issues.
What's the news?
Exactly. And finally, the first congressional staff in the country, or in Congress, votes to unionize 8-0 yesterday. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us. It is Tuesday. I was, of course, out yesterday celebrating Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year, and I will do that.
Well, Happy New Year to you. Earned.
Thank you very much. Emma Vigeland, of course, holding down the fort in my absence.
Yeah. Poorly.
Being a poor Jew. Yeah. Bad Jew.
I am a bad Jew, right? I'm not good at being a Jew.
Not good at being a Jew.
I receive an F letter grade on Jewishness.
There you go. But to the benefit of all of our listeners. All right, let's get right into it.
I mean, it's Newsday Tuesday. Hello.
Oh, sorry. I forgot about your
I like that way better than hump day. Hump day is just like it's just an albatross on me, just
that's
weighing
like
me down.
Hanging around your neck.
That's like that early hit when you're a young band and you're ready to like move on from it, but the crowd still wants you to play it.
Yeah,
like 10
I know.
Years on.
Hump sure. day, hump day.
There you go.
This is my free bird.
Yep. But Tuesday, Newsday, still, you're still into that.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
that's
yeah.
That's good. This is good. If, it's nice to be able to send out a, start the show off with a positive, video. This is taking place at a Northern Virginia high school. And in fact, not just a Northern Virginia high school, but apparently, the high schools all in that area walk out in droves in opposition to, Governor Glenn Youngkin's proposal to restrict the rights of transgender students restricting what pronouns they can use in school and required teachers to out students to their parents. You know, some students who identify as transgender before they begin any type of treatment, it's not uncommon to hear stories of students who leave their house wearing the clothes that they wear around the house, and at one point en route to school or in school, dressing in a way that is more consistent with the gender they're identifying with. I can't imagine a less problematic issue with a student, unless, of course, they have problems at home where their parents will not accept even the idea that a student would explore with their gender, and the child has reason to fear, rightly or wrongly, frankly, sometimes the parents could surprise them. I would imagine in most cases they understand how their parents' perspective is on this. But it really, I mean, I can't imagine a less problematic issue to have with a student.
Well, because, I mean, I'm sorry, but, like, kids have been doing this for time immemorium outside of just, you know, maybe dressing in the gender that they prefer in school, right? They've been doing it, like, wearing a shorter skirt so their parents don't see. It's just normal adolescent stuff, but this has to do with their gender identity.
Right.
And that's why, like, now they have a problem with it.
And so this footage is from Hilton High School in Woodbridge, I guess, Virginia. And apparently Colgan High School in Manassas also marched out. But look at this. Look at the students out here basically saying, you know, this is a good sign for the future.
This is a 90 schools participating, about 60 of them in Northern Virginia.
Check this out. I don't think we have
any. This is just chopper footage. Yeah.
But it's chopper footage. And look at the pullout. I mean,
wow.
A lot of students coming out in support of their fellow students, basically.
Oh, yeah, this is a different school here.
Walking out.
I mean, good for these kids. When I was this age, we didn't have this type of consciousness.
No, not at all.
I mean, there was like sort of like, safe pride areas and stuff like that, I guess. And maybe that's what those developed into, but incredible.
Yep. Really impressive and gives you a little bit of hope for the future. Now, you know, and particularly in Virginia, Northern Virginia tends to be more progressive these days than the rest of the state. But, based upon my experience with a high school student, their tentacles reach, you know, far and wide.
Yeah,
through social media. And so good stuff.
And I'll just say, too, like the fact that Youngkin is trying to restrict students deciding what they want to wear in school that fitting into their gender identity and like saying it's problematic in some way, it feeds into the exact anxiety that underscores why this is politically beneficial for Republicans what they think. That they think that it is coming up in November is because it feeds into like an anxiety that parents feel like their children are not reflections of themselves directly and might have their own identity. And so that's what freaks them out more than anything about it is, I don't know what's happening with my kid at school and they might not be exactly who I want them to be. And that is like a fundamentally, I don't know, narcissistic perspective of being a parent, honestly.
Well, yeah, but I don't even think that, like, this is the, you know, Youngkin rode into office based upon, you know, CRT fears and lockdowns and this concept that dresses up as parents not having a proper say in what's going on with their children. Of course, if parents say, you know, we've worked with our child and we're prepared to move forward with some type of transgender care, then it becomes problematic, right? And the parents no longer have that authority because they've made the wrong decision. But really, at the heart of this, there's no, I mean, the practical implications are probably small. Like, you know, I don't know how many kids this would impact per se. It would be devastating to these kids. But this is really about Youngkin being able to essentially promote a religious fundamentalist perspective, but dressing it up in the context of parents' rights.
Yeah.
And so...
But both of those things, is my point, are about control. They're about control.
I would agree with that. I would agree with that. But I think from an electoral standpoint, the number of parents that are going to be motivated by the actual ability to know whether their kids are, you know, identifying as transgender at school is smaller than the number of parents who happen to be fundamentalist and are anti-trans.
Yeah, the operating thing is the bigotry.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. At the end of the day, it's really about the bigotry. But for a guy like Youngkin, who's got two different sort of like cohorts in his state where he can't afford to be openly bigoted, but he can afford to be like overly concerned with parental's awareness, he gets to basically attempt to have his cake and eat it too. But, you know, when students come out like this and point out this is about bigotry, it makes it a lot harder for him to posture in a different way. So good to the, you know, good for the kids here.
The kids are all right.
At least some of them.
I mean.
Yeah, I don't want to get carried away.
Right.
Yeah,
we'll hear some that get on, booked on Fox News because I wanted to learn math that day and I wasn't allowed to.
Exactly. This is the problem with the Democrats' agenda.
Dorks.
Got a couple of sponsors for the program today. Oh, I love both these sponsors, but I use both these products. But this is a situation where I was using this product, and then coincidentally, they became advertisers for the show. Some of our advertisers, we go out and seek. Some contact the show directly, and some we get through media brokers. And so they had no idea. But I will grow fruit trees. And sometimes other trees, like I got some what they call bloomerang. What the heck? It's lilacs that actually bloom twice.
Ooh,
the Korean lilacs.
That's beautiful.
Yes. But I'm talking about fast growing trees, which you can find at fastgrowingtrees.com. Most people don't realize this, but the fall is actually a very good time to plant trees.
Not the spring.
Well, spring is also good, early spring. But fall is also good too, because it gives it time for the roots to sort of acclimate. Then they go dormant for the winter and they're ready to go well, I was going to say banshee trees. I don't know what that is. And I put in a couple of Korean pear trees very recently. Yes, from fast growing trees. And then coincidentally, they are advertising. The experts at Fast Growing Trees curate thousands of plants so you can find the perfect fit for your specific climate, location, and needs. You don't have to drive around to nurseries. You don't have to go to big gardening centers where they have like four different types of trees and that's it. Fast Growing Trees makes it easy to order online and your plants are shipped to your door within 1 to 2 days. Really quick, particularly right now because it's planting season, like I say, in the fall. Doesn't matter if you're looking for privacy trees, shade trees, or just like beautiful trees or fruit trees. Fast Growing Trees has in-house experts. They are ready to help you make the right selection with growing and care advice available 24/7. Even if you've never had a green thumb, they'll make you feel like you do. Just ask one of the million happy Fast Growing Trees customers around the country. The reason why I love fast-growing trees, because I don't think they actually grow faster, but when you go to fastgrowingtrees.com, you order a tree, you can get a tree that is 6 to 7 feet tall. These are big trees. And so when they come in and you plant them in the ground, you're getting fruit off these trees sometimes that the following season. Like, for instance, these Korean pear trees that I put into the ground in the fall, I'm going to get a couple of pears off them next year. And the other thing that also became huge this year, I realized, it was so hot and dry. There was major droughts in this part of the country. I mean, in many places around the country. And it's brutal on young trees. You get a tree that's 6 or 7 feet tall. It has been grown for a couple of years, and they weather that kind of weather, for lack of a better word. So you cannot go wrong, and they have a huge selection. Go to fastgrowingtrees.com/majority right now. You're going to get 15% off your entire order now through October 15th. So you get about almost 2.5 weeks. That's when you want to put it into the ground, obviously, before the ground becomes too hard. Get 15% off at fastgrowingtrees.com/majority, fastgrowingtrees.com/majority. And, of course, Emma's favorite sponsor today. They didn't do any like copy that's too crazy, but it occurs to me, and I think most people are aware, the Queen died recently. Queen
yeah,
of England.
I know. I'm devastated.
Here's the amazing thing. She is only like, what is it, like three monarchs away from the Victorian era, maybe even less, maybe two, when she was made queen. And despite all of the advances that we have in technology since then, people are still taking care of their business after they go to number two in the way that they did during Queen Victoria's time.
The Queen's asshole was filthy.
Maybe she was a drag on innovation.
It could be just because, you know, everyone's this is the way I do it, so everyone else is going to do it with us as well. Fortunately, in 2022, we have Hello Tushy Bidets. Because as they say, smearing your business around with toilet paper is so 100 years ago. Yep. The Hello Tushy Bidet attachment washes your bum with fresh water. It gives you a way better clean than toilet paper. All you do, you simply spray, then you pat dry. It attaches to your existing toilet. There is no electrician or plumber needed. If you can change your toilet seat, you can put on a Hello Tushy Bidet, and you can do it in less than 8 minutes. Cuts down your TP use by over 80%, saves money, saves paper waste, and I'm telling you, the experience itself I don't want to say mind-altering, but it really changes your perspective on things. Hello Tushy has cleaned over 1 million happy bums. Want all of our listeners to have clean bums. Everyone knows that.
Working out. Yeah.
You can visit hellotushy.com/majority to get 10% off plus free shipping right now. That's hellotushy.com/majority for 10% off. And you can tag at Hello Tushy on social media so they can celebrate your clean bum with you. Make it a little more communal. People are going off on the IMs right now.
We should try to work the Queen dying into every ad read.
We really should.
Well, you know, it had that hook of like 100 years ago, and I'm like, 100 years ago? And then I was like looking at, okay,
wow, the Queen
Victoria
was basically alive then. Yeah.
It's never
well,
time.
Well, Victoria was. Well, the Queen, I don't
100
think...
years ago, she died at 96. She was driven to an early grave by evil Meghan Markle.
Yep, there you go. Yep. But it turned out there was a couple of like kings in between Queen Victoria.
There's a bunch of guys in the 20s and stuff.
Yeah,
weird.
But they went through quick. We had that with the popes at one point, too. They just rushed through.
Well, hopefully their butts were clean when they died.
Yes. Speaking of butt, But Joe Manchin's.
That's a really good transition. There you go.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
You've been in radio for a long time.
Yeah. No, I mean, butthead Joe Manchin there. I am honestly, like, it is, and I don't know, you know, stranger things have happened, but it appears, and today the Senate is going to vote on the continuing resolution. And that is, of course, basically a punt on the federal budget. The as of now, and you always hear, we want a clean continuing resolution from people, which basically means just extend the budget timeline out a month, 2 months, 3 months. In this instance, they're talking about December, of course. They want to get past the election. Nobody wants a government shutdown. You never know how it's going to play on Republicans or Democrats. And so they all want to avoid it. And so it becomes a must-pass bill. And occasionally they'll put stuff in it. This time they have $12.3 billion in economic and military support for Ukraine. I would imagine that is, you know, 300 million of economic and then 12 billion in military. We're pouring money into Ukraine in terms of the military. This is becoming a huge boon for the military industrial complex. With that said, I'm glad I don't have to be in a position of attempting to limit funds for Ukraine when they're being invaded and attacked by Russia. And we've had this conversation. We can have it more about the utter failure of Vladimir Putin to read the room at any point. And this has been a strategic disaster. And hopefully,
it continues to be.
Anyways, $12.3 billion in support for Ukraine, $1 billion for the low-income home energy assistance program, $2.5 billion for New Mexico to recover from the Hermit's Peak Calf Canyon fire in April, $2 billion in additional disaster aid, $20 million for water infrastructure in Jackson, Mississippi. I don't know if that's going to be sufficient. We'll see. It's just amazing. $20 million for... Got a city of 160,000 people who can't even drink their water, and all of this money being spent, 5-year reauthorization of FDA user fees. Those are the top sort of provisions. And, of course, the Joe Manchin so-called permitting reform bill, which essentially makes it removes a lot of the obstacles and time required to complete federal environmental reviews of putting in pipelines. This is just, you know, essentially a giveaway to the fossil fuel industry and a takeaway from the American citizen and the environment of our country, not to mention the implications for climate change. In addition, Manchin just happened to throw in there coincidentally. I mean, it's such a coincidence.
Oh, yeah.
That there is a Mountain Valley Pipeline, which is a multi-billion dollar project to bring natural gas from West Virginia to Southern Virginia. Joe Manchin is from West Virginia. Quite a coincidence. And I would bet everything I own that there are people involved in that pipeline who are major contributors to Joe Manchin's election fund. And I would also bet that, like, you could find some way in which this puts a dollar into Joe Manchin's pocket. And by dollar, I mean a lot of dollars.
Right. So, I mean, what it seems like is going to happen now is, I guess, we'll know within a few hours, right? What happened, what the fate of this bill or this Joe Manchin, you know, what do you call it?
It's basically a rider on the continuing resolution.
Yeah. But he doesn't have the votes from the Democratic side, and he doesn't seem to have the votes from the Republican side. And if they don't get to 60 votes, it seems like Schumer's going to strip it out.
That's right. The thing they'll do is they will debate the bill, and then they will call for cloture on the bill. And there shouldn't be necessarily a lot of debate on this. Rand Paul will get up and saying, we're spending too much money. And there'll be a couple of debate, and then there'll be a motion for cloture. You need 60 votes, like Emma has said, to move forward. If it fails to get that 60 votes, then Schumer, by all accounts, will probably strip that part of the bill. He has another bill ready. They'll go through that debate. They'll go through the cloture, and then we'll see. But like you say, there is Bernie Sanders has been vocal about it. There could be some other progressive senators who will be voting against cloture. The Republicans seem to want to punish Manchin.
Yeah.
And according to the reporting, senators are privately saying Manchin doesn't have the 60 votes needed to get cloture, despite the fact that he's been lobbying.
It's really just a tough sell to one, like Republicans want to be vindictive because he had that agreement with Schumer, and two, to Democrats who have no majority of the party has no like love lost for this guy, to attach basically his own pet project to a continuing resolution. What's in it for anybody else? This was a backroom deal for between Schumer and Manchin, and so he's been like, all this weekend, Manchin was on his doing what he loves most, going on Sunday talk shows and trying to lobby for this, took out some op-eds. And there's just like no momentum behind it because this is all for one guy, basically.
Right. Well, and to be clear, like, you know, there is no doubt that weakening the permit process for pipelines is detrimental to the environment, both from a climate change perspective, but also from a perspective on like what happens if there's a leak. If you weaken the environmental review of an area and there's a leak, you're going to have greater environmental destruction, period, end of story. I imagine if he had just gone for like, can I just get my pipeline so I can get my money? Like that may have worked for him, but it appears it's going to go down. We'll know more going forward. We should also just hit on this story because it's funny, about Ken Paxton.
Oh, yeah.
This is from the Texas Tribune. So apparently, and this happened yesterday, right? A process server, a guy named Ernesto Martin Herrera, was attempting to serve, this is the attorney general of the state, a subpoena for a federal court hearing that today in a lawsuit from nonprofits that want to help Texans pay for abortions out of state, right? They're attempting to prevent women from leaving the state, preventing pregnant people from leaving the state to get abortions. A lot of these people who need abortions and can't, who want to leave the state, cannot afford to leave the state. Time off from work, transportation, housing, et cetera, et cetera. And so there are nonprofits that are trying to go in and pay for it. The state attorney general is trying to prevent that. So Herrera arrives at Paxton's home in McKinney, I don't know where that is, on Monday morning. He told a woman who identified herself as Angela, that is presumably Angela Paxton, right? Paxton's
right,
wife.
Yes.
And he told Angela that he was trying to deliver legal documents to the attorney general. She told him that Paxton was on the phone and unable to come to the door. Herrera said he would wait. So nearly an hour later, Chevrolet Tahoe pulls into the driveway and 20 minutes after that, Paxton exited the house. So I'm not quite sure. So I walked up the driveway approaching Mr. Paxton and called him by his name. As soon as he saw me and heard his call his name out, he turned around and ran back inside the house through the same door in the garage. Angela Paxton then exited the house, got inside a Chevrolet truck in the driveway, started it, and to open the doors. Now, I don't understand, like, who pulled the truck into the driveway?
I don't know.
I think she got pulled it closer from, like, in my mind, I imagine she pulled it from, like, somewhere either on the street or in the driveway into the garage.
So he could go right in.
And then they pulled out of the garage. Yeah, yeah. Is that...
A few minutes later, I saw Mr. Paxton ran from the door inside the garage toward the rear door behind the driver's seat. I approached the truck and loudly called him by his name and stated that I had court documents for him. Mr. Paxton ignored me and kept heading for the truck. Herrera eventually placed the subpoenas on the ground near the truck and told him he was serving him with a subpoena. Both cars drove away, leaving the documents on the ground. Okay, and here's the weird part, right?
We need a reenactment.
Yeah.
Yeah, we need to see, like, one of those, like, don't they do that? Where do they do that?
On, like the local news?
In Taiwan or in Singapore, they do, like, these reenactments.
Oh, right, CGI ones, yeah.
But here's the weird part, that Paxton ultimately says that, in a tweet, right? Do we have this or something like that? It says, it's clear the media wants to drum up another controversy involving my work as attorney general. So they're attacking me for having the audacity to avoid a stranger lingering outside my home and showing concern about the safety and well-being of my family.
Huh.
Now, here's the strange part. Like, he clearly was not worried about the well-being of his family. Why is he sending his wife out there to get the truck?
His wife, who also happens to be a state senator in Texas as well.
I mean...
also a politician, yeah.
If you're genuinely... I mean, if you're the attorney general and you're genuinely worried about your safety and your family's safety because there's a guy lingering outside with an envelope...
Shouting, apparently. That's what Paxton says.
Yeah, shouting, I've got papers for you. Which is, you know, some. I mean, if you're genuinely scared about your family, do you send your wife out to get the truck ready so that you can just run in and lock the door?
Yeah.
And then, like, why don't you, if you're the attorney general, just call the police?
Right.
Well, I do like the fact that he says that it's, like, another controversy being drummed up on his, like, because of his political enemies or whatever. You mean the one where the fact that you're in under indictment for securities fraud, that one that's being drummed up by your political enemies, or the fact that you're being, like, sued by a variety of whistleblowers who've talked about how you abuse your office? Like, this is not, there's nothing really being drummed up here. These are hard charges right off the bat.
But that's the funny part about it, or the strange part, is that why would he avoid a subpoena about, like, a case that involves him as the attorney general?
Yeah.
He obviously thought the subpoena was for something else, like maybe the things you mentioned, or maybe some other case that he thinks is lingering out there and he doesn't want to get caught on it.
Yeah. I mean,
what's his official position?
Attorney
general.
Right.
So he knows when someone comes to your house and says, like, oh, I have legal papers for you, that is somebody who's trying to serve you with something.
He's
right,
like a Better Call Saul character.
Yeah, I know.
Very strange. All right, well, look, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we got more to talk about in terms of the Senate races. We will get to that and the messaging that the Republicans seem to be running on after Trita, probably in the fun half. But we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Trita Parsi, Executive Vice President at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, about the protests that are happening in Iran and how the Biden administration is reacting and handling the situation. We'll be back in just a moment. We are back. Sam Cedar, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. Joining us now, Trita Parsi. He's the Executive Vice President at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. Trita, thanks for joining us again on the program.
Thank you for having me.
Let's just start with this wave of protests and protest movement. I think it's fair to call developed, or I guess, I don't know, you can characterize exactly how it sort of manifested itself after Mahsa Amini. She was a young woman who was detained by Iran's morality police and essentially killed in detention. Fill that story out for us, and then give us a sense of sort of like what has been building and for how long that this one particular death has sort of like exploded this protest movement.
I think you're quite right the way you're framing it, because obviously there's a tremendous amount of anger as to what happened to Mahsa Amini and many others who have been harassed for a very long time by the so-called morality police. But this obviously goes deeper than that, because there's been such deep frustrations that have been building up for a very long time. And it's not just that the economic situation is disastrous. It's not just the repression of the regime. It's not just the mismanagement and the corruption. It's also, I think, very strongly that this new generation that is out there protesting right now, because if you take a look at the images, you see there's a lot of young people. Many of these people were less than 10 years old when the 2009 protests took place. This is a generation that essentially has lost faith in the idea that change can come through reform internally, peacefully. And they have lost faith in it. It's not clear that they have an alternative path except for protesting. But precisely because they don't have faith in that reform option, they're much quicker to go out and express their anger. And if you listen carefully to what the slogans have been, previous protests, they started off economic protests, and as the regime repressed them, you know, you could see that their calls and their slogans became harsher and more forward-leaning, and eventually calling for the downfall of the dictatorship or, you know, death to the dictator. This time around, that happened within a day. Very quickly it went to that, because it's just there isn't much of a faith that the system can reform. Now, whether that's right or wrong is a separate issue. It's just that is the sentiments of a lot of people who for the last 20 years have seen that the effort for reform, which have been genuine, have constantly been blocked. Things have gone backwards. People are talking about the era of Khatami 20 years ago as almost as a golden era, you know, when it comes to the freedoms that existed then compared to what exists now.
If you could, I mean, I think people probably have a notion of what the morality police are. But if you could, fill us in, I guess, on what they are exactly. But in the course of that, how much of the fact that the protests grew up around the death of a woman, and the death of a woman because she was not adhering to the rigid fundamentalist religious edicts. How much is that relevant, as opposed to, let's say, I don't know, it could have been somebody out, I guess I'm thinking of the Arab Spring. Like it could have been, a guy selling fruit at a cart, beaten by police or something like that. Or, you know, like how specific of this, what does the fact that this was the catalyst tell us about what's going on there?
It says a couple of things. First of all, when you take a look at the protests in 2017 or 2019, those were more lower class, middle class, poorer class people coming out because of economic frustration. Now you're seeing the middle class coming back out on the streets. They're the ones who have, I would say, if we generalize, more of a problem with the Ershad, the so-called morality police, Not that the others don't, but that's where you see this pain point coming in. And I think what it's really about here is that people feel like their dignity has just been completely violated. It's the last thing they have in a situation that has no economic hope. You know, it was an explosive situation that just looked for some sort of a trigger, and it ended up being Mahsa Amini. And I think it also shows very clearly the very, very crucial and important role that young women are playing in this. And it also goes to the point that the Islamic dress code of enforced hijab is essentially a pillar of the system. So this is attacking the very core of the system. This is not a peripheral policy. This is something that was that came with the revolution, that the Supreme Leader constantly talks about as being one of the critical elements of the revolution. When you scratch the surface, however, you see very clearly that this is about control, and they much rather draw the line at the hijab rather than drawing it at something that actually is more important to them, and then using religious symbolism as a way of further enforcing and winning support in certain parts of the society for this. So all of these things, I think, are quite crucial. And it shows that this is quite different from what we've seen before. Whether it will lead to the type of results that the protests are hoping for is a completely different question, because this is, at the end of the day, still a protest movement whose leadership structure essentially is not that what you would expect of something that ultimately can bring down a very entrenched system like this. It may be able to move the goalposts or move the ball forward quite a bit, but whether it will be ultimately successful without a leadership emerging remains to be seen, and I'm a bit skeptical about it.
You talked a bit about, and you mentioned there, the economic hardships playing a role in some of the unrest here. And I guess I'm just curious about the dynamic of Iran being fairly isolated because of the United States' relationship with Iran and other nations essentially blocking them off from trade and other international economic opportunities. And this is in no way absolving the regime here of the way that it's repressed women, et cetera. But to me, that would make protest movements even more of a tempest in a teapot, right? Because there is less of a release valve from outside influences, which allow for there to be some more help. Is that an accurate assessment of the situation?
I think it's very important to recognize that there is a context to all of this in which the tensions between the United States and Iran and the sanctions that the U.S. have imposed definitely play a very important role. Again, as you said, it doesn't absolve the hardliners in the regime as a whole, from the repression that they have been engaging in for more than four decades now. It doesn't absolve the fact that it is the hardliners that ultimately have been the key reason as to why reform has not been permitted and has been constantly blocked. But they have been aided, in my view, undoubtedly, by the policies, the hawkish policies coming out of Washington. I mean, if Trump had not pulled out of the deal and if Biden had gone in quickly as he could have early in his days, I'm not so sure that the hardliners would have won the elections, because I'm not so sure that people would have sat out the elections. The only reason they won is because people didn't vote. But with Trump pulling out, Biden not going back in, it really destroyed this last argument that the reformists had, which was that their path of trying to find some sort of accommodation with the United States was essential towards bringing Iran out of its economic difficulties and many other difficulties that it has and move the society in a more open direction. That had then been disproven by Trump pulling out and then the hesitation that we saw in the Biden administration early on. So I don't think we would be in this situation now. Some of the supporters of those policies will make the argument that, well, thanks to those policies, that's why we have protests right now. And, you know, there wouldn't have been protests otherwise, and it's a good thing. Well, yes and no, perhaps, because at the end of the day, I think what we saw in 1979, it's one thing to go out and protest. It's another thing to bring down a tyrannical regime, and it's an entirely different thing to replace it with a democracy. There's no one who I think doubted that a lot of economic pressure and sanctions and strangulation of the country wouldn't lead to protests. People have been saying that all along. Yes, it will lead to protests. Will it lead to democratization? That's a very different question. And that's not necessarily what we're seeing now either. I fear that the regime is going to clamp down really, really hard on these poor young people who are just trying to get their dignity. And they're going to become even more marginalized and even lose even more hope for their future without this actually either bringing down the regime, let alone bringing about a democratic replacement.
I want to return to that crackdown and their response in a minute, and as well as the way that the Biden administration is reacting to this, as opposed to the way the Obama administration reacted to protests that took place during its administration. But I'm sort of fascinated by the I think your point is well taken. There were two options essentially to getting to a more democratic, less repressive Iran. And one was like slow incremental reform, where the reformists needed to be rewarded for their actions in trying to, rejoin the international community. And then there is the other one where there is a revolution, but it's really hard. The Shah left in 1980. It seems highly unlikely that the leadership of Iran now is going to leave. They're going to fight to the end, and they have a revolutionary guard that is been far more vetted, it seems, and to be loyal, you know, to going down with the ship, as it were. So with those two options, but what really intrigues me about this too is that we're 42 years out, I guess now, maybe 43 years out from the revolution. And they're still like, the revolution has been unable to re-educate the Iranian people to get rid of this impetus of like, we want to be part of modernity in the sense that, you know, women should have certain rights and should have certain sovereignty and abilities. Like, talk to that to a certain extent. Like, how successful has that part of the revolution been?
Well, I mean, on the surface, obviously, the regime is extremely repressive and is denying women a tremendous amount of rights and dignity. But Iran's women's movement and civil society has never rested, and they've been pushing back extensively and have made significant gains. But many of those gains have also then been lost at times. So it's an ongoing struggle. And I wouldn't say that the regime in any way, shape, or form has been successful, because if it was successful, it wouldn't have to constantly fight. Then it would have actually succeeded in convincing the population of some of its values, and it has not. It has failed. The only reason why it keeps on being able to impose them is because of its repression. So it's not changed Iran society in the sense of going along with this. In fact, even amongst conservatives, there's a lot of criticism, even voices calling for the morality police to be closed down, because they're also recognizing how this is creating completely unnecessary tensions inside the country, pitting people against each other, and that it is excessive and it's simply wrong. And many conservatives are even questioning it on the basis of their understanding of Islam. So I think in that sense, the regime has been utterly, utterly unsuccessful. The very idea of the revolution in many ways have failed. What hasn't failed is that the people who have power still cling on to the idea that they should have power. They're not giving up power. They can give up all kinds of principles, ideas about the revolution. They're not giving up power. And they have blocked those who have tried to open up the Iranian society, expand the political spectrum. In fact, this political spectrum now is much more narrow than it was 20 years ago. That's part of the reason why a lot of people, even though they may not think the alternative to reform is particularly fantastic, they have nevertheless given up on the idea that reform can work, because they're just not seeing that the regime is capable of giving space, of saying yes. And the long-term effect of that is that the more they repress people, the less space they give them, the less oxygen, the more people are eventually going to come out on the streets and demand their rights in other ways, even though it may be a repeat of what happened in 1979, which was a similar situation. The Shah was not giving an inch, and eventually all various factions of society coalesced against the Shah, but that didn't necessarily mean that it would lead to a democracy.
What is the relevance of this woman being Kurdish? Because my understanding is that there is some ethnic divide in Iran. I noticed, I think today, the Iranians struck Kurds in northern Iraq. What's the relevance or lack of relevance, or does the lack of relevance, the fact that she was ethnically Kurdish, mean anything as to what's going on?
I really don't think that that dimension is relevant or important. First of all, yes, the Kurds, like many other minorities, like the very majority of Iranians, have been repressed, but the minorities more so. There's no question about that. I fear that actually that there's an effort from the government side to make this more of a Kurdish issue in order to then be able to cast it as a separatist issue. Whereas that's not what it is. This is, she was visiting Tehran. This happened in Tehran, not in Kurdistan. In Iran and Kurdistan. And it has everything to do with the broader factors that we've talked about here. And there's been a lot of protests outside of Iran and Kurdistan showing sympathy for her and joining the fight for dignity and freedom for the Iranian women, which, again, it crosses all kinds of religious and ethnic lines. I'm a bit wary about that narrative because I think it actually may be coming from the other side. I want to cast this as a creeping separatist issue and then clamp down even harder.
I just am curious a bit about, if you were following up to that, I can ask this later. I was just curious a bit about how significant the clamping down from the Iranian government has been on the internet and apps like WhatsApp. In terms of trying to crush protests, because, you know, the official death count is probably higher than the dozens that we've seen. I would imagine that some of the information that's coming out has been a bit spotty. What's been your assessment of how they've been trying to stifle protests in that way?
They are stifling the protests. They are clamping down on the internet, but it is actually quite different from what it was 2 years ago or 3 years ago when they closed down almost all of the internet at a huge economic cost to the regime itself. This time around, it is much more localized. It's temporary in time. They're closing it down in ways to make sure that they can prevent protests, but they're not closing it in such a way that it will have a significant economic impact. I have to say, and this may not be very popular, but based on their conduct right now, I'm not seeing the regime panicking. This is not the signs we would see if that was taking place. They're doing everything they can to clamp down. They're doing everything they can to make sure that images don't come out. But they have much more sophisticated tools and capabilities now compared to just 3 years ago when it comes to how they're doing this. I would suspect that the death toll is much higher than what we have seen or heard so far. There's a lot that has not been seen because of the difficulty of getting images, etc. out. But still with that, this is, I'm not seeing the panic or even the full scale of the repression that unfortunately this regime is quite capable of.
How much of the regime's reaction has been muted because you have the Iranian president, Raisi, am I pronouncing that correctly? Yeah. Having been in New York at the UN, how much of that, what are the implications? How much of that was sort of like tempering their response?
I think it was a factor. I think we saw a harsher response once he was back. They didn't want to do anything that would have gotten even more embarrassing, repressive images coming out while he was in New York. So I do think that was a factor that caused them to delay what they were inevitably going to do anyways, just to make sure that he was back in the country before they did it.
The Biden administration, will you compare and contrast the Biden administration's response to the Obama administration and why you think they're taking a different tact and how helpful you expect or you perceive it as being?
I'm not so sure that actually, frankly, is that different. I think the small changes may be overemphasized a little bit. I think we also have to recognize that these are very, very different protests. In 2009, you had 2 million people out in the streets of Tehran. It had clear leadership. It had clear organization. There was ways for the administration to indirectly communicate with them. I'm not saying that the leaders of the Green Movement wanted much direct communication at all, but there was a way of sending messages. The message was very clear for them. They did not find it to be particularly helpful for the United States to speak out or to do things that made it look as if the U.S. was in the corner of the Green Movement. These were still the very same people who actually brought the revolution 30 years earlier. This was a fight within the revolutionaries. It was a fight for reform of the system. Today, it's different. Again, no clear leadership structures. People who have lost faith in reform. I'm sure the United States has a way of getting some messages from some protesters, but whether they speak for the larger movement or not is completely unclear. And let me also say, later on in 2009, from the people on the streets, two or three months into it, yes, you could hear disappointment. They wanted stronger condemnation from the United States and from President Obama. But I think it's important to understand what had happened to the movement at that point, which is that the leadership had been largely being cut off from the people on the streets. And the people who were on the streets 2 months, 3 months into the protest were not necessarily the same people who were out in the very beginning. So there's almost two different movements. And the latter one definitely wanted more support from the United States, at least more. I think this time around, the administration is looking at it and it's not seeing the same situation. And as a result, feels that speaking a little bit quicker about what's going on and taking some actions in terms of sanctions on the morality police, lifting the sanctions on technology that had actually made it more difficult for Western companies to provide and offer apps inside Iran. I think those are all very positive measures. I'm not so sure the Obama administration would have dealt with it differently had they been in this situation. The situation in 2009 was very, very different. And I think, frankly, they handled it right. I was in communication with it at the time, and I thought it was very clear. They were not trying to, you know, what they were doing was not performing. They were trying to make sure that what they did not hurt the movement, that they didn't get in their way, didn't make the United States a factor.
Is the Biden administration's willingness to be more vocal in support of the protests, is that a function, too, of the nature of the protesters at this point? Not just in terms of like but rather that you said that they're coming from the middle class, that the ability of the Iranian government to make it seem like they are simply puppets of the United States is less, and so there's less of a danger in coming out and being supportive?
I think it goes back to the fact that, first of all, what they're doing is that they're expressing support for the rights of women and men in Iran to be able to protest, to be able to have their dignity, not be harassed. They're not echoing calls for regime change, for instance. Now, if they had done that, then I think we could have a much more proper conversation. Why is Biden different from Obama? But they're not doing that. They're just expressing, in my view, quite correctly, support for human rights, calling out. I wish they did it for all the countries in the Middle East, but that's a separate conversation.
Right.
But what they're doing here is what they should be doing. They should be calling out these human rights violations. They should be calling in and calling on the police to not use excessive force or use force in a way that violates the rights of ordinary people and respect the rights of Iranian women and men. Put some targeted sanctions on the specific elements within the police that are responsible for this repression. That is still, in my view, very much in line in trying to, on the one hand, stand up for the right of the protesters, but not make the United States a factor, not go into some sort of the U.S. is behind regime change. I mean, you can imagine what Trump would have done. In fact, what he did when there were protests in 2017 and 2019. So I think perhaps some in the administration want to differentiate themselves from the Obama policies for a variety of reasons. But in essence, when you look at the scale, they're still doing pretty much the right thing. And I think Obama himself would probably have done exactly what they're doing if the circumstances were the same in 2009.
So two final questions. One is, are there any implications for the nuclear deal that will come out of this? Or is that like on its own sort of misguided trajectory, regardless? And second, like what should we be looking at in terms of what happens next to get a sense of where this might go or not go?
So as we have discussed before, right now, the JCPOA is in a deep coma, and neither side feels that they want to wake it up from that coma because it's not a good situation that it would wake up to. It's actually in some ways better for both sides not having to deal with the issue. Do you pursue negotiations in this context when the Iranians are beating up and killing people on the streets? I'm sure the Biden administration is terribly happy not having to deal with that issue right now. Now, if the there would come a moment to wake it up from the deep freeze prior to these protests, it would have happened after the midterm elections. So we're talking about 5-6 weeks out. That's when that moment would have come. And it may still come then, because we don't know exactly what's going to happen in the next couple of weeks, whether this will fizzle out, whether there will be continued protests, perhaps even larger protests. If you have much larger protests, then I think you will see that it will have an impact on the JCPOA. The Iranian regime may not feel comfortable and confident to even engage in those negotiations while dealing with major demonstrations at home. I'm sure the Biden administration would not be happy being seen engaging in that negotiation in the midst of such a clampdown. And similarly, that's exactly what happened in 2009. The Obama administration didn't close down the path for diplomacy, but it waited until August, September before any diplomacy actually really took off. Because they wanted to first see what would happen on the ground in Iran. And once they came to the conclusion that the regime was back in control, they still had a nuclear program that needed to be stopped, the protests were not going to lead to anything in the short term, that's when they chose to go and reignite diplomacy. I think we will see a similar pattern here. If the situation is different from today, after the midterms, I suspect that we will see some sort of effort to revive the negotiations once more. If we're in the current situation, or perhaps even worse, then I don't think either side will have much of an interest of actually reviving the JCPOA. It may actually be better off for both of them for it not to be dead, but to still be in a coma.
Trudha Parsi, Executive Vice President at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half of the program. You can support this show by becoming a member. Go to jointhemajorityreport.com. You can help this show survive and thrive. We rely on our members for 92.3% of our revenue, and you are that person. So, again, if you have the financial means, jointhemajorityreport.com is the way you can support this show. Also, don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Dorsey, who works in the back room here at the office.
The windowless closet that we stick him in.
We stick him in a back room at the closet, and every now and then we let him go out for vacation, and he went to Wisconsin. He was vacationing in Wisconsin recently. He said he saw Just Coffee everywhere.
Wow.
Out there.
Interesting.
Well, Madison is, you know, fairly centrally located in the state, and it is a co-op, and it makes great coffee, or they make great coffee. And they also really take care of their suppliers in a way that a lot of coffee distributors do not. If they're not getting the beans from one farm because weather or a flood or whatever it is, they'll just move on to the next farm and leave those people high and dry. They do not do that at Just Coffee because they have a political ideology in which they operate around. And so not only can you get great coffees and teas and chocolates and a variety of this stuff, all fair trade. And not only can you get the Majority Report blend, or if you really want to, the Marc Maron blend, whatever, or other blends. But you're also working with a great company, justcoffee.coop. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off.
Whoa.
Emma, what happened on ESVN yesterday?
So we discussed among a bunch of things the Udoka saga, how the scoop media in both in sports media has kind of ruined, I think, sports journalism for a section of the population. It's all about getting there first as opposed to figuring out what the details are. We also just discussed.
Also, isn't there an issue with like some reporters like being having agents the same as athletes? Like,
yeah, I mean, that's
be a little bit of ethics and sports journalism problems. Going
yes,
on.
We discussed that a bit. Where Woj probably got his initial, this was consensual take, as well as Brett Favre's ongoing saga with the law, and then we recapped NFL Week 3, including was it a labor issue for the Bills-Dolphins game to continue to play in that heat, as well as how terrible Russell Wilson has looked, and if it's Nathaniel Hackett or him or both, and more topics. You can check us out on the Majority Report channel where we did our show, and then also check out our YouTube channel and the podcast version.
Matt, what's happening in the Matt Lekien media universe?
Yeah, tonight, Left Reckoning, Darna Neuron, we're talking about climate change and the IRA. And in the post game, Kale Brooks is going to join us. We talked to Kale for about 50 minutes about MAGA communism. And Kale is somebody who's not online, but is sort of familiar with communism. So we had him sort of assess it.
What is the reaction of somebody who is not on, never mind being online, like not on Twitter? They've just got to be like, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
Yeah, the general thing was it was unpleasant to sort of be subjected to and very stupid and incoherent. So that was his assessment of MAGA communism.
You know, the amazing thing is that like the Twitter sort of like YouTube universe, you know, that combination has gotten just, it seems to have like shrunk and shrunk and shrunk, and where it's like you're talking to like, normal human beings have no idea, even like politically active people
yeah.
who are not in this sort of very narrow world have no idea. Like, I see sometimes like memes going like, you know, like the old left is dead, and it like includes like us and like the Young Turks and like like four or five other YouTubers.
Jacobin.
And like, well, but it's like, that's the left in your perception?
Yeah.
Like, wait, like it is so narrow. It's fascinating. There are people who exist in such a small, narrow world who don't realize that, like, we're not even a fraction of a fraction on some level. We're, you know, that would be like, I don't know, attributing...
I mean, even people who like us sometimes get the impression that we're more significant than we are.
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating. It would be like literally like being at a baseball game and not confusing like the commentators for the players, but confusing people sitting in the stands.
Yeah,
who are doing play-by-play.
With like, the first base coach.
Yeah, exactly. Like, wait, what?
But, yeah, it's just, honestly, it's like, I feel like it's almost the way fandom operates to a degree. Like, it gets narrower yeah. and narrower the more obsessive and parasocial it gets for people. And yeah. So, like, they just, then it becomes one crowd who's obsessive and they speak to them. And that seems, it artificially inflates how influential they are to just people like us, right?
It's a problem. It's a YouTube problem, largely, in yeah. my mind. Like, it's not. You don't see that in the audio podcast world, really, in the same way at all, because it's just not as like enticing, and it involves like listening as opposed to viewing, which I don't know. It's strange.
Yeah.
Someone should write something about that. Folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now. And I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now. And I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now. But I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What? What is that going on?
It's nuts.
Wait a second. Hold on for a second. The Majority
Report. Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Matt.
Who? What is up, everyone?
Nomi Keen.
You did it. Let's go, Brandon.
Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today.
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women.
Stop talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But dude, you want to smoke this, 7A?
Yes.
Hi, me? Is it?
Yes.
Is this me?
Is it me?
It is you.
Is this me? Hello, is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? Oh, no sound. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
I'm going to go start
that way. Libertarians.
They're so stupid though.
Common sense says of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him!
So what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge met.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I want to say. 857-210-3501. 1/2. 3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$5.43 trillion.
Sold.
It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less of
it. But let me say this.
Poop. You can call it satire. Sam goes with satire.
On top of it all,
yeah.
My favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt. Hey, buddy, we see you. All right, folks.
It's just the week being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, sun's out, guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled, folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Look, gotta jump. You gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock, we're already late, and the guy's being a dick. So screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you, bye.
Love you. Bye-bye.